Confucian kid, you know, said yes, please, thank you. But there came a point where I stopped saying yes, please, and thank you, where I stopped asking permission. A lot of Asians growing up, sometimes we get caught in the belief and the guilt of having to live our life for our parents. To live for yourself is a big valley, you know? Slanging tacos on the street and expressing ourselves, feeding the city of Los Angeles, feeding the imagination of America, it's a big thing for an Asian kid.
That was Roy Choi, creator of the Korean taco truck Kogi and several restaurants in Los Angeles. And he's one of the chefs who's helping to revitalize Chinatown's food scene. We'll talk about that later on in the show. First, though, an 11th student was arrested at Venice High School yesterday for alleged sex crimes. 10 others, all boys, from the ages of 14 to 17 were arrested Friday. Police are still looking for three other students. They're investigating sex crimes allegedly committed by the boys against two female students over a period of more than a year. According to authorities, some of the incidents were coerced, others were consensual. Joining me now is Leonard Levine. He's a defense attorney who specializes in sex crime cases. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, the accused are all minors, as far as we know so far. And so what can they be charged with?
Well, they can be charged with the same offenses an adult could be charged with, which is a rape by coercion or duress or force, if that's applicable here. But there are different penalties and different procedures if they are juveniles or if they are adults. The thing to remember, though, is that if you are 16 or over and you are accused of a serious offense such as forcible rape, the district attorney's office can certify you to adult court and try you as an adult, as they could do in a murder case, for instance. So the key age is 16. Over 16 or over, you can be tried as an adult. Under 16, you have to be tried as a juvenile, and the district attorney's office has discretion on how to charge the case depending on your age.
And does it matter if the victims were all minors, were both minors? Does it matter if some of these acts were consensual?
No. If they are consensual, even though technically sexual acts with a minor under 18 are unlawful in California, it's rare, and I've never really seen consensual acts among high school students, for instance, who are dating and so forth, engage in sexual conduct, ever charged criminally. The key here is whether those acts were forced or coerced. If they were, then you're getting into the allegations of forcible rape and so forth, as opposed to what we call statutory rape, which just means under the age. And if it's force or duress, then I've seen a minor's charge with raping other minors, as you would expect. Just because they're minors, it doesn't mean they could get away with that kind of activity. Consensual, I would not expect it to be charged at all.
Right, right. Well, you specialize in this on the defense side. When you first heard about this story, what did you think? Were you shocked at the seeming large scope of this?
Well, the first thing I would remind your listeners is that these are just allegations, and often the truth when it comes out in court or later on after investigation may be different than what is reported. We're living in a time when any sexual misconduct among high school students, college students, and so forth is looked at far more carefully than perhaps in the past. And sometimes this can result in prosecutions that are not based on the law or the facts, but based on a desire to be overly careful in terms of this kind of conduct. I would look first to see whether these acts were really coerced or duressed or whether they were consensual in nature. If they are consensual in nature, I would doubt very much that it will go any farther than the arrest. If you really had force or coercion, as the law defines it, then of course it is criminal and it should be prosecuted.
Okay, and we don't know much about this yet because not a lot has been said about this. Would you be surprised at all if some of these kids were charged as adults?
I would not if the conduct was so serious and egregious that it rose to that level. I would certainly be surprised if they were charged as adults if the conduct was basically consensual or if the allegations were simply that there was some kind of peer group pressure and so forth. I would expect that to remain on the juvenile court level.
And what's the responsibility for the school in terms of creating a safe environment?
Well, you just said it. The school's responsibility is to create a safe environment as best they can. And if the activities took place on the school campus, that's one thing. If the activities took place off of campus, of course, it's difficult for the school to know what's going on there or to control it. So it depends on who's involved in the school, if anybody, and what actions the school took in response. And here, obviously, the school and the law enforcement have taken quite aggressive actions in this case for the reasons that I think I made clear.
Well, what about the way this all went down? The police came in, showed there was a big show of force. They handcuffed these kids. You know, it's become a big media story. I mean, they knew the kids' names. They could have been called to the office. It could have been handled more discreetly.
Well, as a defense attorney, we always would prefer that these things be handled discreetly because, after all, an arrest is not a conviction. It's not proof of any kind. And once you start parading these things in the press and on television, radio, then, of course, you know, the public and the jury, the danger is they'll be prejudiced against these students before they even know the facts. So I would prefer that it had been done a different way, but that is something that law enforcement chooses to do in its own discretion, and unfortunately these days it seems more often that it's done the way it was here with a show of great force and fanfare than in a private manner that we would prefer.
Have you dealt with a similar case?
I've certainly dealt with cases involving juvenile victims, rarely with juveniles who were the accused, but sometimes I have, and those cases have remained in juvenile court, fortunately.
Leonard Levine, defense attorney who specializes in sex crime cases. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Joining us now is Dennis Danziger. He's an English teacher at Venice High. He's been there for 7 years. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Well, describe for us what the mood is like there on campus.
It's quiet, unusually quiet. It's a little eerie. I think students may feel that they're still a little bit in shock over what's gone on.
Do you know any of the students involved?
No.
Do people know who they are?
I know one teacher who knew, who supposedly knows one student. The people who are my colleagues on campus don't know.
Mm-hmm. And you were telling my producer earlier that the security situation at Venice High has suffered because of cutbacks.
Absolutely.
Can you describe that?
My first 6 years here, things were very calm. I think there have been cuts to security, teachers, and there's not enough eyes out. I've been told that there was a gang of students who took over one of the buildings, that they commandeered a bathroom, smoking dope there, maybe dealing drugs there, intimidating people. Since we've reported that, the school police, the administrators have been better, but there's lots of kids roaming campus. There's lots of kids roaming the halls. This didn't happen when I first came here. This didn't happen until recently, and I think part of it's the lack of security. And quite honestly, I and a number of my colleagues are very concerned about it.
And you're concerned because it's scary, not only...
I'm concerned that people can walk on campus. I'm concerned that there's a distraction to learning, that it makes teaching more difficult. It makes you want to close your doors and not open. I haven't had this experience for a long time in the LAUSA.
So basically, kids could come and go on campus without anyone taking notice. They can be roaming...
Well, we're an open campus, so... it's a big campus. People could walk on. The security that works here is very good. My concern is there's just not enough. It's a big place.
And there is, I understand, an interim principal, an interim vice president principal, because the principal left. So has there been a kind of lack of leadership at the top, or has it been chaotic at all?
She's very good. I think the faculty likes her a lot, but I think sometimes when you have interim people who are only here and we know there's an end date, sometimes it's difficult to get certain things through, I believe. We're in the process of looking for a new principal. But there's also been interim assistant principals, and they're only here for a certain amount of time. So there's a lack of continuity, and as one AP told me the other day, there seems to be a lacking of a chain of command when teachers and staff need help.
And do you know if there are any counselors on campus or any sexual assault awareness programs?
I was told that there on Friday there were multiple people from the West Side. I think the district is always very, very good and very prompt about getting counselors and extra people on campus. I think the one thing about the LAUSD is that in crisis like that, they are superb and They were here on Friday, and I suspect they're still here today.
Well, what happens before the crisis hits? Are there counselors on campus?
There are counselors on campus, but their workload is overwhelming. So I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of students they have per counselor, but certainly not enough to kind of have a vision of what kids who are hurting really, really need, or kids who are in trouble really, really need. They're working on getting kids in the right classes, getting kids graduating on time, taking the right tests. But I'm sure my school, and I suspect a lot of high schools in the LAUSD, could use twice as many counselors as they currently have.
And just one more question on the security. Yeah. Is this something that happened because of district-wide budget cutbacks, or something that happened specifically to
the
school?
Assault on campus?
The lack of security.
My guess is, I don't know. I was told that they were interviewing for more security earlier in the year. I haven't seen them. I thought we lost a few security people, and I don't think they've been replaced. But we certainly feel it. We certainly feel more vulnerable. I feel more vulnerable now on campus than I have since I've ever been here in the previous 7 years.
Well, Dennis Danziger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So we hear a lot about sexual violence on college campuses, but not a lot on high school campuses. The Centers for Disease Control says 10% of high school girls say they've been raped by a peer in any given year. A lot more say they've been sexually assaulted or harassed. Kelly Hampton is here now. She's with Break the Cycle, which works with high school students to try to prevent sexual assaults. And she also lives near Venice High. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, thanks for being here. What was your reaction when you heard about the story at Venice High?
Well, you know, as with any of these cases, you know, it's a very sad situation. And, you know, of course, you feel for all of the parties who are involved, particularly the survivors of this assault. But to me, it's not surprising. We know that one in every third young person experiences some form of dating abuse in their relationship, which is basically an epidemic.
An epidemic. And when you say dating abuse, what do you mean by that?
So dating abuse encompassing sexual abuse, but any type of physical abuse, emotional or verbal abuse, as well as financial abuse and abuse perpetrated through technology or social media.
All right. So what is the particular situation on high school campuses? And in terms of sexual assault, are high school campuses talking about this at all? There's been a lot of talk recently about anti-bullying campaigns, but does that also reach into sexual assault?
Sure. Well, one thing we do know from our work in actually middle schools and high schools is that while there is some talk about sexual assault, particularly through the Title IX law, there is not enough conversations that are going on about it. It seems that while, and I think this was alluded to earlier when speaking with the teacher at Venice High, but there's a lot of other things that are happening on high school campuses, and sexual assault is not necessarily seen as the most important thing for folks to be addressing. But one thing we do know is that intimate partner violence, which includes sexual assault, really can and not only affect those individuals who are directly impacted, but also the community at large.
So what is the best way of trying to raise awareness on campus? I mean, you've got a group of kids who don't necessarily want to hear from adults about, you know, sexual matters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So one of the things that I think is first and foremost very, very important is that all staff on middle and high school campuses need to be educated about the dynamics of dating abuse and sexual assault. So what does it really look like? You know, what should they be looking out for? And then also how to respond to disclosures of abuse, because I think that is a barrier for a lot of folks, a lot of teachers, administrators, and other staff in terms of knowing what to do when something like this happens. In terms of educating young people on campuses, I think what we've found to be the most useful is to really approach young people in an authentic way. So, you know, these are real issues. These are issues that are, so issues of violence, I mean, they're normalized now in young people's lives. They see violence everywhere in their homes, in their communities, in social media. So really taking that as an opportunity and saying, look, all of this is happening both in your life and outside of your life. Let's talk about it. And having that authentic conversation seems to be the best way to really reach young people and talking about these sensitive issues.
In what's been talked about so far in the media about this case in Venice, the The victims were allegedly told, not to say anything because of their reputation, that their reputation would be hurt, that they, that other kids would be told about what was happening. So, I guess there's an incentive there not to talk about it when it comes to peer pressure. So how do you, as an adult, how do you break through that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think it's really up to the schools to create sort of a social norm that it's a safe space to talk about these issues, and that it's not about discipline, but it's about learning and growing. I mean, these are young people we're talking about. You know, these issues, you know, we've dealt with, young people who've experienced sexual assault and sexual violence at very young ages. Young people are experiencing this, and they need to talk about it. And schools are a great place to sort of have a safe environment to work through some of the difficult issues that young people are facing.
So we just heard from the teacher that there wasn't necessarily mm-hmm. the safest of environments at Venice High, but he also was talking about a lack of counselors, enough counselors on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Would that go a long way to helping foster a different environment, or would kids look suspiciously at even going to talk to a counselor?
Right. Well, one thing we do know about, just dating violence, domestic violence, and sexual assault, as well as stalking, is that, young people and adults don't always want to talk about issues, even if they're able to identify that something's going on. They may not want to talk about it. So while it's really important to have, yes, more counselors would be wonderful, it's also important that the school commit to prevention education, whether that be, utilizing all, the various curricula that exist out there, programs, connecting to local resources, so organizations like Break the Cycle who go into schools and do, can support staff who might be tied up doing other things or have limited resources in starting these conversations with young people and then helping them seek the help that they need.
Well, when it comes to prevention, how do you talk to boys?
Oh, that's a great question. And there's a lot of work going on right now around engaging how to engage young men and boys in the conversation. And I think the first sort of accessible way to work with young men is to make sure that you're not approaching them with blame. That you are approaching a young man and a young woman in the same way and saying, okay, these are issues that affect all of us, and we need to start working through what this looks like and why this is normalized behavior and why violence is normalized behavior in our community. So I think first is approaching young men in a non-judgmental way, and then just really educating and helping lift men and boys up and saying you can contribute to a safer environment for all of us in that way.
Kelly Hampton is director of programs at Break the Cycle. That's a group dedicated to ending teen dating violence. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you.
Parents, is this something you have talked to your kids about? How do you talk to your daughter? How do you talk to your son? Let us know by leaving us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, editing Wikipedia, how New York City police officers were discovered editing pages on high-profile cases, like the page for Eric Garner. He was killed during a struggle with police on Staten Island. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Anonymous edits to Wikipedia pages that deal with the New York Police Department have been traced to computers on New York Police Department servers. Edits to wiki entries on things like the death of Eric Garner, on prominent figures in New York police leadership, or on the NYPD's controversial stop and frisk program. All altered in what appears to be an attempt, in some cases at least, to whitewash questionable actions by the police. Well, that goes against Wikipedia's conflict of interest guidelines, and it further shakes public confidence in the transparency of the NYPD. Kelly Weil at Capitol New York uncovered all of this, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, what got you interested in this in the first place?
So I've always been interested in how much is public versus private on Wikipedia. And that's something I don't know if everyone's aware of. But essentially, there are two ways to edit Wikipedia. You can either do it logged in with the username and password, just like you would in most other social media places, or you can do it anonymously, in which case it logs your IP address, which is the identifying code for your computer. So I knew that you could search these IP addresses and see who had edited what, and I just got to thinking, I wonder if anyone from the New York Police Department had edited it, and if so, I wonder if I could trace that.
Well, what made you suspicious to even think that they might be editing Wikipedia pages?
You know, I wasn't so much suspicious as it was, I know how many people do edit. I know it's very tempting, especially if there are pages like the Eric Garner page, which don't reflect wonderfully on the New York Police Department. And because they have about 50,000 employees, I was just thinking that there's a good chance that someone in the department had edited at a certain point in time.
Okay, so let's talk about Eric Garner in particular. He was the man who died on Staten Island during a police chokehold. It was later discovered during the autopsy that he did die from that. And what does it say on the Wikipedia page?
So initially it had said that he had died in a chokehold. It said that he had his arms raised, I believe. But what was changed afterward were a few things to, A, make it seem like the NYPD had taken less controversial actions, and B, make it look like Garner had been resisting more. So one thing that we saw was where it had said, you know, he was placed in a chokehold, that was changed to chokehold or headlock, and headlock doesn't carry the stigma of the word chokehold. And also the bit where his arms were raised, it was changed to he flailed his arms around. Someone added a sentence about how he was considerably larger than any of his arresting officers. So there were really attempts to change the rhetoric around this event.
And so to make it less damning for the police department?
Exactly. And to, in my opinion, implicate Garner in his death a little bit.
And this happened with other high-profile deaths, such as Amadou Diallo?
That's right. They did that with Amadou Diallo, and actually for Sean Bell, who was another man killed by police fire under controversial circumstances, they attempted to delete his page altogether.
Okay, so how did you discover that the police were actually doing this?
So what I did is I looked up the block of IP addresses that the NYPD had registered, and that's 15 to 16,000. It's a huge number. And, you know, I had a few minutes, so I just manually started copying and pasting them into Wikipedia to see if anything came up. And I was very fortunate in that one of the first ones I found was the IP address that had edited Eric Garner's information. So that immediately sent up a red flag. I'm like, wow, okay, I wonder what else is in here. So I must have copy-pasted another few hundred, maybe even 1,000 IP addresses before I said, you know, there's got to be a faster way to do this. And a much more tech-savvy friend helped me write a quick program that would just run all the IP addresses through Wikipedia, and we let that run for an hour, and we ended up with a list of 85 IP addresses that had edited, and they had made several hundred edits over 10 years.
Oh, wow. And so were they all controversial, or were some of them more benign?
No, in fact, most of them were benign. You know, there were edits to banned pages, edits to the pages for UFC fighters, just sort of edits the average Wikipedia user might make. But there were a number of edits to, you know, the New York Police Department page. Even some of those were benign, you know, just changing spelling. But there was a recurring thread of someone editing pages that made the NYPD look bad, definitely editing things in which they had a vested interest.
And was this just a select few IP addresses that were doing that part of the editing, or was it all of them?
It was a select few, and that's where it gets a little bit murky as far as I can tell who was doing it, whether it was one person or multiple. I can't tell if it was one person on one computer, or even if that computer registered as multiple IP addresses because of a proxy server thing. But yeah, it was just a select few IP addresses that had made controversial edits.
Now, I guess they have the right to do that, right? I mean, it's not against the rules to edit pages on Wikipedia?
They do have the right. So what Wikipedia does is it has a conflict of interest policy. It says it strongly discourages people from editing pages that they might have an interest in, be that their employer, something that they have a financial interest in, even a page about themselves. I know a journalist who has a Wikipedia page, and he's pointed out inaccuracies on it, but he won't go in and fix it because it's a conflict of interest on his part. So you are technically allowed to edit it, but they strongly discourage it. And then on the police end, they don't really have any rules about officers editing. I spoke to them the other day, and they said, you know, our only issue with this is that it's someone using a work computer for personal purposes.
So I understand two officers have been identified as responsible for some of these recent controversial edits. And do you know who they are and how they were disciplined, if they were disciplined?
No, I don't know who they are or which precinct or even which borough they're in. They haven't released any information as to that, and I haven't been able to prove concretely who those people are. So no, I don't think we are going to find out who they are. And from what it sounds like, they will receive maybe a slap on the wrist punishment. And again, the only reason they are being punished, I spoke to a deputy commissioner the other day, is he said for, you know, using work time and work computers for personal purposes. He made the comparison to using a work computer for shopping during the day. And it's the same infringement, even though it's going on and editing things that they really, I don't think, have much of a place editing. But that's why they're being disciplined, if they are being disciplined at all.
Well, it makes you wonder if other police departments, other agencies are doing the same thing.
I did wonder that. And in fact, since I wrote this article, I've been contacted by a number of reporters from other cities around the country who are asking, you know, hey, what code did you write? Because we'd like to run that for our own local police departments. And where I could, I, you know, sent them code that could help them look through these things. But yeah, I think it's very tempting, especially if you don't know the conflict of interest policies, and maybe whoever made the edits genuinely thought they were helping improve accuracy, genuinely thought Eric Garner was fighting back and thought they'd make that change. I think it's very tempting. And for that reason, I think it's probably likely that other officers across the country have made edits.
And then there's a Twitter account that automatically monitors now whether or not an edit has been done regarding the police department, the New York City Police Department.
Yeah, and I believe it's NYPD Edit. So what this account will do is every time someone edits Wikipedia from an NYPD IP address, it will automatically tweet. It will tweet the page that they edited and when. And since that account went up, it hasn't had to make a single tweet yet because no one has been editing Wikipedia from the NYPD since this article went up. So I'd like to think maybe there is an internal memo saying, hey, you guys have to stop doing this. But who really knows?
Well, it seems like they're lying low for at least a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does also raise the bigger issue about trusting what you read online and trusting Wikipedia.
That's right. You know, there have been countless people who just, you know, mess with it. There's a funny anecdote I read maybe last year of this woman who, when she was in college, she and her friend would edit, you know, just tiny details to pages about children's authors. And she went back years later, and not only was the edit still there, countless people had based articles on this crazy edit she made. So you do have to take everything you read with a grain of salt, especially from Wikipedia, which, while it's, I think, often accurate, it is written by often amateurs.
Kelly Weil writes for Capital New York. It covers the city and state politics of New York. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, more Wikipedia. A day-long edit-a-thon attempts to give women artists their due. That's after a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When you search Google for George Washington or semiconductor, the Wikipedia entry is the first thing that comes up. And that shouldn't be too surprising. Wikipedia is the seventh most visited website in the world. About 100 million Americans visit it every month. So if something or someone isn't there, they kind of don't exist. The problem is that the people who create Wikipedia pages are overwhelmingly young, white, and male. And so the result is that Wikipedia tends to be very white and male. The editors aren't bad people, they just write about things that interest them. And that means, though, that a lot of stuff gets left out. So people have been holding what they're calling edit-a-thons to rectify that. They get together, learn how to edit wiki pages, and create entries for people who have been ignored. For instance, students at Howard University held an edit-a-thon during Black History Month this year. They expanded the short entry about Myra Adele Logan, the first woman to perform open-heart surgery, and they created an entry for NASA astrophysicist Beth A. Brown. Press Play producer Matt Holzman attended a recent art and feminism edit-a-thon, and he has this report.
The Art and Technology Lab at the County Museum of Art is basically just a nice little library. But at the front of the room, there's a counter that looks a lot like a Genius Bar at an Apple store. Only today, people here aren't learning how to use their iPhones. They're learning how to edit Wikipedia.
The thing is, it doesn't want you to leave your edits unsaved.
Stacey Allen is the editor of an online art magazine called East of Borneo, and she's one of the hosts of today's event. This is the ninth edit-a-thon she's worked on.
I definitely think of it as an activist project, and I think a lot of the people who attend the edit-a-thons do as well. They're here because they want to help correct a wrong.
The wrong they're trying to correct here today at LACMA and at events like this all around the country and the world is that a lot of important female artists just don't exist, at least on Wikipedia. And especially in the art world, which is all about perception, that is important.
Grab a seat at one of the tables and you can start working, and then before
the 15 or so women here have volunteered to right that wrong, one artist at a time, like Anne Kong Nguyen. She's the digital scholar at Whittier College. This is her third Wikipedia event this week.
I'm working on Tiffany Chung, who's a Vietnamese-American artist based in Ho Chi Minh City. I've been really interested in her mapping, her cartographic art. She'll make embroidered fabric maps, or she'll do pen and ink maps. She's globally a very important artist, but she didn't have a Wikipedia page. But one of her collaborators, who was a man, did, which is really interesting.
Penny Richards is a mom with a doctorate in education. She's an art teacher, and she's a serious wiki editor.
I created all 54 of these entries. So I'm working my way through a list of people who won lifetime achievements from the Women's Caucus for Art. So you can assume that they were prominent people, that they were respected in their field, and a lot of them still don't have Wikipedia entries.
I am creating a wiki entry for artist Catherine Murphy.
That's artist and illustrator Jane O'Neill.
Catherine Murphy is an American painter who has been living and working for over 40 years. She was included in the Whitney Museum of American Art. It was a 1971 exhibition of painting and sculpture. She's gone on to receive two National Endowment for the Arts Awards and most recently a Robert De Niro Senior Prize Award.
How did you discover that she didn't have a page?
I started searching around for artists that I care about and I'm interested in. And, you know, she's been in tons of interviews. She's represented by galleries. She was a lecturer at Yale for 22 years, but no wiki entry.
And then in here, you have to put the URL.
The technical parts of creating a wiki entry don't seem too complicated. If you've ever posted a blog page, most of the stuff would look familiar. What's maybe more involved is learning how to write an entry correctly and then taking the time to do it.
How many hours do you think it will take by the time you're done with this entry?
It's a bunch, yeah. Maybe 6 hours of work, 8 hours of work. It's a good day's work. And, you know, remembering how to write a term paper.
And it's not just about writing a post. It's making it stick. Wikipedia entries are made up of information that's already out there. But women artists often work on subjects and with media that isn't necessarily very commercial. And art that doesn't sell is less likely to get written about. Margarita Nafpaktidis is another volunteer here today. She's a librarian at UCLA.
One of the challenges of an edit-a-thon is that you have to go and find something written about that person that, you know, that was not written by you, yourself, to start to build up that article so that there is something there when people Google one of these women artists.
A wiki page that some volunteer wrote today could disappear tomorrow if somebody else comes along and doesn't like the sourcing or feels like there's a conflict of interest. For instance, an artist or their gallery can't create their own page. To make sure that the posts that get created today stick around, the organizers of this event have created folders filled with research to quote from. But the nice thing is that you don't necessarily have to write the definitive article. You can start an entry and then someone, maybe somebody at the next edit-a-thon, will add to it. Event organizer Stacey Allen says those entries don't just mean established artists finally get the recognition they deserve, but can actually affect the careers of newer artists going forward.
People think about Wikipedia as somewhere between late journalism and early history. So we're kind of like right at that in-between point of trying to influence sort of what scholarship might be produced in the future, but having, in some cases, very little to work with.
And that is the brilliance of Wikipedia. People like you and me and volunteer Margarita Nofpaktidis can actually make a difference.
I think that's why Wikipedia Editathons are so great, because it gives you something that you can do to bring this person, you know, out into the forefront. It seems better than just being like mad and, you know, kind of whining about it. You can actually do something, making people aware that there's some really cool women out there who've been doing really amazing art.
Women like Catherine Murphy, the realist painter, who didn't have a wiki page until today's Editathon. I called her up at her home in Hyde Park, New York, and asked her to take a look at it for the first time.
What do you think? Does it make sense?
So far, it seems just fine. I have a firm pictorial mind. It doesn't feel very firm today. It seems fine. I didn't read it very well, but there's nothing, no glaring mistakes. It doesn't confuse me with the other Catherine Murphy, who I think was the last woman hung in England, but, you know.
That's good.
Yes.
I wanted to play Catherine Murphy a piece of tape of Jane O'Neill, who created Catherine's wiki page.
How do you feel about the fact that this person is not represented on this, probably the single biggest source of information online?
It's shocking to me, and I guess I'm really trying to understand, wrap my head around more about how Wikipedia works. You know, as a kid, you know, you read Encyclopedia Britannica, and you just trust it as some kind of authority on what history is. And then as you grow up, you realize there's so much bias and exclusion when you're studying the history of art or the history of the world. So, yeah, it's kind of amazing that we can change that a little.
It's really great. I mean, it's true. But I'm very fatalistic about lots of things that happen or don't happen for me. But I think it's absolutely true that, power structures are made that we don't understand. And I'm also very touched that this person that I feel like I've taught the whole world, because I've taught for so many years. But as far as I know, she was never one of my students.
No.
And she went out of her way to do this. I'm very touched by that. I think it's wonderful. You make these paintings and you put them out in the world and you don't even know. And she's all the way in Los Angeles, and somehow she's been in touch with me, and I think that's miraculous somehow.
But it sounds like the fact that you didn't have a Wikipedia page was not keeping you up at night.
No, it's always been miraculous to me that I managed to attract any attention. I'm not being modest. I mean, I think I'm the bomb diggity, you know. But in fact, I'm always surprised when people make a connection with the paintings that is a deep one, and it's wonderful, surprised in a wonderful way. But I'm a child of the '60s. I didn't get into this for almost anything other than my own bliss. And you also know with artists, I know there are some that are really out in the world, but most artists spend their entire life alone.
Yeah.
And I go into a studio every day. I come out bleary-eyed, eat dinner, watch television, read a book, go to bed. So that I can reach the world and never leave my studio.
Yeah. Well, the digital age has truly made that possible.
I know. It's really fantastic.
Fantastic connections were made to a lot of artists at last weekend's Art and Feminism Wikipedia Editathon. The volunteers at LACMA alone created something like 40 new wiki entries. Overall, there were 500 participants in 17 countries, and they created or improved almost 1,000 articles. For Press Play, I'm Matt Holzman.
Do you have a Wikipedia page, Warren Olney?
I do not. Not that I'm aware of. Yeah, maybe I do. I'll have to look.
You will have to look.
Yeah.
I'm going to look while you promote your show.
All right.
Tell me what's up at 1 o'clock.
Well, we're going to have a great show on the free trade agreement that's being negotiated all over the Pacific Basin with 12 countries. 40% of the global economy is involved. And we'll talk about what it means to people here in this country, or what it would if, in fact, it ever got passed. We'll also have a wonderful interview about plastic surgery in the capital of plastic surgery, which is Seoul, South Korea.
It's not here?
No, it is not here. We're only sixth. And South Korea is first and Brazil is second. And we'll find out what they do there.
Wow. Okay. I can't wait to hear all that at 1 o'clock. By the way, you do have a Wikipedia page.
Okay. I'll go look at it.
Learn something about yourself.
Yeah, you never know.
Coming up on this program, Chinatown has some good Chinese food, but the hottest new restaurants, they don't serve any Chinese food. None at all. We'll get a guide next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA's Chinatown has ceded most of its food prestige to the San Gabriel Valley over the past few decades, but it's kind of getting its cuisine groove back now with a spate of new trendy restaurants like Pok Pok LA, Chago, Little Jewel. None of these restaurants, though, serve Chinese food. Joining us now is Catherine Spires. She's food editor at KCET. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
All right. So talk a little bit about these new places opening up in Chinatown. Who's opening them and what do they serve?
Sure. Well, the interesting thing about the latest crop of restaurants in Chinatown is that they don't serve Chinese food. So that's kind of different and new. Roy Choi started the trend sort of when he opened Chago, which is a Korean-inspired rice bowl joint. There's Ramen Champ, which is Japanese, obviously. There's Pok Pok, which already opened one location, and it'll be two locations while serving Thai food. There's Little Jewel, which is Cajun-style food. Those are the most interesting ones at the moment.
And why Chinatown?
Well, there's a couple reasons, I think, why Chinatown is becoming such a culinary destination. One of them, it's such an obvious answer, the rent is really cheap there.
Really, still, even though it's close to downtown and Echo Park?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised too, but for whatever reason, rents are still really cheap there. Hmm. And there's a lot of space. There's a lot of empty storefronts there right now, so there's some landlords who are eager to get tenants in there. Another reason that's kind of funny that kept coming up when I asked new restaurant owners why Chinatown is there's a grocery warehouse there called LAXC. It's more popularly known as Thai Costco. And it is where you can get any kind of Asian ingredients that you want.
Really?
Yeah. It's open to the public, and everyone should go there and just poke around and see all the really cool food and kitchen implements that
they
have.
Is it really big, like Costco?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge warehouse. And then the third reason why a lot of new restaurant owners are opening in Chinatown is Roy Choi himself. He's really been encouraging people to come to the neighborhood. He and a man named George Yu, who's in charge of the Chinatown Business Improvement District, they're just champions of the area. And they're just telling everyone to come on in. They're giving tours. They're supportive. They're into Chinatown.
Yeah. Well, if anyone can do it, Roy Choi can.
Yeah, absolutely. He is a trendsetter again and again.
And quite enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. So what are the old time tenants think of all this?
Well, what some of the new restaurant owners told me was that they first came in and they started bringing their restaurant equipment, and the old restaurant owners were not happy. They were worried about these new restaurants coming in. Once they figured out that they wouldn't be serving Chinese food at these new restaurants, they all became best friends and everything's great and they're completely supportive because they don't really need other Chinese restaurants coming in and providing competition. This isn't competition exactly. It's bringing people into the area.
But it's competition for a single meal, I guess.
That's true. That is true.
You can't eat two dinners.
Right. Or can you?
You make a good point. All right. So when this kind of thing happens, the word gentrification isn't far away.
Sure.
Is that also what's happening, perhaps, or what people are fearing is happening in terms of rising rents?
Yeah. People are talking about gentrification in Chinatown right now. And, you know, it depends on your view on gentrification. Is it a bad word or is it a good word? I mean, truly, like Little Joy, the building that they're in now had been empty for over a year. And when they reopened it, not the restaurant, but when they reopened the building, it was full of vermin. And they had to spend months and months getting it up to code. So they got rats out of that block by doing so. I don't know if rents have gone up yet, again, because it's so cheap for everyone. But like Andy Ricker, who owns Pok Pok, he said a rising tide lifts all boats. And he really just thinks it's going to improve the neighborhood.
So tell me more about Pok Pok, because they're opening two restaurants, or one's open and they're opening another one soon.
That's right.
And tell us about the person who's behind Pok Pok and Tell us about their food.
So Pok Pok is a Thai restaurant. It started in Portland. They have some locations in New York as well, and this is their first foray into Los Angeles. It's owned by one man named Andy Ricker, who just became obsessed with Thai cuisine at some point in his early 20s and made an mini empire out of it. It's kind of funny that he's bringing Thai food to LA because we have the best Thai food in the country, but he's going for it. He's not afraid. His first restaurant that's already opened, it's just a noodle joint. It's a small menu. You get your noodles and whatever protein are on it, and then you actually season it yourself, which is how street food is done in Thailand. And then the other restaurant that is yet to open will be a slightly more formal setting with a bigger menu and a more varied menu.
And is it authentic Thai?
I always get nervous talking about authentic food. Yeah. I think it tastes really good. I've been there and I really like it. I think it is authentically served and prepared, and everyone has an opinion, but sure, yeah, we can say it's authentic, I think.
And there's also dessert that's not Chinese dessert?
Sure, yeah, because a lot of people aren't going to like Chinese dessert. It's not very sweet at all. So to solve that problem, there's a new branch of Scoops that's actually in the same plaza as Ramen Champ and Chego and Pok Pok. That's the Far East Plaza. It's definitely the center of all the activity. So it also has Scoops as well with their, you know, Oreo and brown bread flavors. There's nothing Asian about that, that's for sure.
So the people who live in Chinatown,
sure,
are they going to these restaurants, or is it mainly people from elsewhere coming in?
It's probably people from other neighborhoods coming in, generally speaking. There aren't so many people actually living in Chinatown. And those that are, in terms of, you know, what the census has found about Chinatown is that it has one of the oldest populations of any neighborhood in Los Angeles. A lot of them are widows, and it's not a high-income area at all. Yeah, there could be locals going in there. But I think one of the reasons why people like George Yu is so invested in these different, more diverse restaurants coming in is so that we get people from other neighborhoods coming into Chinatown.
And people are?
So far, so good. Yeah, I mean, every time I go down to, there's always a line outside of Chego. Little Jewel is, there's a ton of people in there all the time. I think that they're doing well, the restaurant so far, yeah.
So are we looking at a new Highland Park, a new Abbot Kinney, a new Silver Lake?
We might be looking at a new Highland Park. I don't think it's ever going to become fancy. Chinatown has gone through this before where they were sort of on the edge of becoming cool, you know, in the 70s and early 80s when the whole punk scene was happening down there. But it never became, you know, a fancy destination, and I don't think it will still.
So it needs a tattoo parlor.
Yes.
It needs a coffee shop. Yeah. And it needs a CrossFit.
Yeah. And then it'll be set.
Then, hello, Highland Park.
Yes.
Catherine Spires, food editor at KCET. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, Christian Bordahl, it is lunchtime, so...
Yes, it is. I'll try to make this brief.
I'm really hungry now after listening to that.
Uh-huh. Well, we talked earlier about Wikipedia.
Yep.
And how Wikipedia pages are put together. And the fact that apparently some New York Police Department officers, people from the NYPD, mm-hmm. have been editing pages in which they have an interest, like
yep.
the Eric Garner page, for example. Conflict of interest policy of Wikipedia being broken in that case. And it just is so clear. Like, it's kind of amazing and cool that Wikipedia, the place where so many of us now go to get our basic info, is put together by a bunch of people on their own time who have editing parties and that kind of stuff. So we asked our listeners whether they get their info from Wikipedia and whether they trust what they read mm-hmm. there. And Sia says that even though everyone says the wiki info is unreliable, it's still my go-to source, and that's because Google sends me there. So wherever Google sends
well,
me, I guess.
Kids scroll down.
That's where we go.
A little bit.
SMC says I use it to get an idea of where to go for more info from better sources,
mm-hmm.
But I don't try to edit it. And we also started today with the Venice High School story about 11 students who have been arrested allegedly for sex crimes against two girls at the school. We asked listeners about that story, and a listener came back, Judith Martin Straw. She says, we have had similar problems come to the surface at Culver City High School. She doesn't elaborate, but she says, my children have been part of an OWL program. It's an acronym for Our Whole Lives, through their church. And she says it's the best sex ed curriculum out there, and understanding consent is a part of that education. So that's the mail for today, Madeline.
All
time
right.
For lunch.
Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And if you would like to weigh in on anything that you've heard on the show or anything at all, please do. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney and To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon, hopefully full of lunch. I'll see you tomorrow.